This is a Glass Box Media podcast.
Lauren.
Mike.
So we host a podcast for Wired called Gadget Lab.
We do.
We do.
Yes, that is correct.
Tell the good people some more about it.
Well, I think the good people should definitely tune in every week because they get to hear me roasting you.
Hey, now.
All right. No, really, what Gadget Lab is Mike and I tackling the biggest questions in the world of technology. I like to think of it as the best of Wired's journalism, but in audio form. We cover the big news of the week in techland, but we also offer our expert analyses and opinions on all things consumer tech, whether that's mobile apps, hardware, startups, cryptocurrency. Mike, what's been a recent highlight episode for you?
We did a deep dive on the group behind the massive Okta hack. Mm-hmm. We also had a great conversation about Web3 and the metaverse. What stands out for you?
Never metaverse you didn't like. I really enjoyed our recent podcast about Peloton. And recently, the legendary tech journalist Kara Swisher joined us to talk all about Elon Musk and the future of Twitter. So I guess we should tell people how they can listen to our pod.
We release a new episode of Gadget Lab every week, and you can listen and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you pod.
Today on Around the Coin, I interviewed Jorge Garcia. Jorge is the CTO and co-founder of Hello Ionic. Hello Ionic has helped tons and tons of companies, large and small, everywhere from Coca-Cola, Disney, ABC, Fox, and more, all the way down to small companies, specifically in payments and fintech, crypto included, help build out their technology platform. And this could be product strategy, design, engineering, research, or other. There are about 70 people now. They've been around for over 10 years. And Jorge has a very unique perspective into the landscape of crypto and fintech and payments because they're building these companies, these products from the ground up. And so I really enjoyed Jorge's unique perspective. We talked about the direction crypto is going, the common patterns of engineering problems that are occurring in the crypto space and the payment space at large. I learned about the immigration process. Jorge immigrated to the U.S. recently, and we talked about that process as well as a few other topics. So very much enjoyed this one, and I hope you do as well. Here is Jorge Garcia. All right, Jorge, thanks for hopping on today. I'm really excited to chat with you more. You mentioned pre-show. We were discussing you're in Philly now. You're from L.A., and you just took a trip to South By in Austin. We're recording this on March 18th. What was the vibe of South By? Is maybe in respect to the organization coming out of a pandemic, wherever we are now. How was the event?
Thank you, Mike, for having me. Definitely happy to be here. South By was great. I mean, I think it was the first one after pandemic. So they had to cancel. If you see the dates, they had to cancel right in the middle of like when it all started. I think it was great. Like a lot of people attending. I've been a couple of more times. Definitely was less than previous years, but there was a significant audience. I think that's one thing. You could tell that people just wanted to hang out, go to the talks, go to the parties, of course. It was great. I did talk with some locals and they were also like happy just to, I mean, that helps the economy as well. So I think it was just a general, festivity. I think that was cool. There was also a lot of like meetups. Ink Magazine had the Ink House, Capital Factory had their event as well. There was a fintech house as well. I know there was a crypto house. So you could tell that there was like the South By general, but also like those specific per topic kind of places. Yeah.
And certainly South By splits it up into three different categories, tech being one of them. How big was crypto within that? Was crypto a huge presence, would you say, or did you have to go and look for it to find it?
It was huge. So if every time that I go to South By, there is this specific topic, right? Like a couple of years ago was the 3D printing, for example, and then VR hit at some point, and AR. This year it was a lot of crypto. Doodles had a house. Basically, they had like a whole store with Shopify. There were many, many talks about crypto. Many companies were doing things with NFTs. I think, honestly, I think that probably one of the main subjects, if not the main subject in South by this year was crypto for sure. Yeah.
Mm. Did you learn anything specific coming out of those talks?
That's a really interesting question. I think we're very much in the field, but I think it was good to see things like, I mean, the DAOs, the legal perspective on that. I think one of the key insights that I learned, I forgot the name, but it was about how he formed a DAO and then basically he had to let go, because when you form a DAO and then to achieve full decentralization, the whole point is that it's a self-governing organization. So they formed the DAO, they had an organization, they put it to run, and then after a while they dissolved the organization, the kind of like the LLC or the company that was doing it, and then the DAO is running. I think that was one of the most interesting takes that I saw there. And I mean, you could tell a lot of like companies are trying to figure out the kind of like the NFTs, how to commercialize them. The ApeCoin came a couple of days later. I wasn't there, but it was at the end of Interactive when it happened. So that was also an interesting.
When what happened?
To see the launch of the ApeCoin, the
Apes.
Yeah, so they just launched the ERC-20 ApeCoin token. So that's interesting. But that, I was already in New York when that happened, but that was at the end of Interactive. So I can imagine something must have happened during the event there. Yeah.
How big a deal is that? How big is Bored Apes now, would you say? I mean, tell me what your thoughts are.
It's huge. I mean, it's still uncertain, right? Like it could be just a hype or anything, but I think the team has been able to execute pretty well. They have a strong brand. So I see, I mean, within all the uncertainty that we may be seeing the first kind of like consumer media company out of the Web3 world. And I mean, with this ApeCoin, which they're kind of using, they use it to raise some capital, give some liquidity back to their people. But seeing Alexis Ohanian, for example, being on the board there of the ApeCoin DAO, I mean, I don't know, like it does look that it's something big is happening there. I think they have demonstrated that they can execute and that they can think big. So I think we may be seeing one of the first like huge full consumer brands out of the Web3 world. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Are there any other specific crypto projects that you've been excited about recently?
That's a great question. Well, we're working with a couple. So I'm actually pretty excited and working very involved in one that is called Studio DAO, that it's about creating and funding companies, and also basically that all the filmmakers, writers, they're part of the DAO. So not only in the traditional model, there is a company like Netflix, they have some funds, they fund the content, they end up owning the content. So what the rest of the people see is not exactly everything that the content generates. I think that DAO, for example, is doing really interesting things in that sense, that how do you create that collective of creators, and they create, and at the same time, everybody gets rewarded by the content they create. So I believe that at some point, either a Studio DAO or any other DAO in that field could become the next studio. Like what's a studio in the Web3 world? Like, I mean, there's the Disneys of the world, there is like a Universal Pictures, but what's the next studio that has come out of this new Web3 economy, right?
Do you think Disney, Pixar, these more traditional studios will have the ability to trans? I mean, to me, it seems like it could be a pretty fluid transition, given that it's going to be likely a very technical and expensive build out. You know, if you're building entire worlds, it's not going to be like just spinning up a website. It's going to be, you know, the person who can create the most entertaining and engaging and complex storylines is going to win. And I tend to feel like what we're seeing in media, where there's a lot of consolidation with Apple and Netflix and Amazon all spending tons and tons of money on media, it's like it seems like there's a consolidation effect, which I imagine that same thing would be true in VR when it really rolls out.
Yeah. So the way that I see it is, Larger companies tend to be slower and risk adverse. So definitely you can see Disney, Sony was doing something, but they're more into creating NFTs, some sort of reward mechanism, collectability and all that. So you can see that. So I think just as Netflix was kind of like the new studio from the Web 2.0 world, I believe there's going to be a Web 3.0 version of what Netflix was, what Disney was before, and they still are. I think we may find out that there's going to be, I don't know, a sixth player in the space. We have done a lot of streaming and entertainment in the past, so I know I've seen the consolidation. I saw Fox and Disney merge directly. Like we basically were working with both of the companies, and we saw the collision of those planets basically. And the same thing, I just see that there's going to be a space. Like there's still the need for different content. We kind of saw it with Netflix, that they started to fund content in Latin America and East Europe. So you start to see all those things. And I'm always wondering, what are we missing? Like, what is that content that somebody for some reason didn't want to fund? But given the right conditions in the more decentralized way, we can see that content being funded, being produced, being commercialized, right?
That's a good question, or a good way to think about it, whether there's a gap in the market for funding for content. Certainly, the first thing that comes to mind is really edgy content, right? Whether it's like sexually explicit or vulgar or horrific. But I don't even think that necessarily is, I don't think that there's a big market that's not being addressed because of some unwillingness to fund it. You know, it seems like for the most part, the big hits are storylines like Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, action movies. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I love you. I love talking to you. I was really excited to dive in with you because you have this visibility with Hello Ionic and that you see sort of underneath so many companies. Most people I talk to, they have the vantage point of their company, which whatever it's doing, it's usually pretty interesting or innovative. But you guys are helping other companies build out their product strategy and engineering teams and that kind of thing. You've mentioned, this is the list I have, Disney, ABC, like you said, Fox. I'm sure you've worked with a ton of other awesome companies. Are there patterns? Like the first thing I want to ask you is when you first get into a company, when you know they bring you guys in, you're the SWAT team. What's your protocol on assessing where the product is? Let's keep it within the product realm, but how do you sort of calibrate and figure out what's going on? Because it could be kind of overwhelming, especially for really large companies.
Yeah. So it's interesting because we work at Hello Iconic, we work with different kind of companies. So we work with the very large business of the world. We work with early stage, recently funded companies as well. And we also work a lot with Series A. So it's those companies that have a product and need to kind of like expand. And all of them behave in different ways. So for example, the large ones, normally they already have some infrastructure in place. And so they bring you kind of like to add capacity, but at the same time, move faster or create a product, but within that has to be compatible with the infrastructure that they already have. So for example, they asked us, okay, can you develop for us the Roku app? But they already have all the backends, like all the streaming. So it's a lot of, okay, understanding what's your product on other platforms, what are the specifics, for example, for Roku? And then what's the architecture and the infrastructure that I already have? A lot of who is the owner of each of those things? Because at those companies, you have to kind of like understand who owns that. And it's normally like an infrastructure person. There is a content platform. There is a client-based platform. There's the PMO, that's called. So it's a lot of people. So I think the challenge in very large companies, it's a lot about what's the goal, but at the same time, okay, what's the current setting? Who are the key people there? How to coordinate that and then move that forward? So that's one of the things that I see. On smaller companies, like if they're very early, it's actually about normally people, when they want to launch a product, like a startup, they have an idea, but then in reality, they have a lot of ideas and the product could be in different ways. So part of our job is trying to understand, okay, this is all that you want to build. but where do you want to go first? And try to lead them through a process where we can understand that, help them like prioritize, then kind of like design, define some flows, design, and then we can build something. Sometimes it's about, are there technical risks? Or is that that you want to build, is it possible? So we build a proof of concept. It's like, okay, we understand you. If this is, I don't know, in crypto or is in fintech, let's just build this component of it just to see if your hypothesis is possible. And then if that's possible, then, okay, let's build the rest of the product and the business around it. So that's on those stages. And then Series A startup, for example, they already have a product, already have a team. It's all about joining with speed. So basically, is you have to be ready to run. It's like, okay, we want to work with you, want to hire you. We have this product and we want to launch this feature. We're going to put you in charge of that specific feature. So it's about forming the team and then just plugging right away and then run with it. Like just launch in, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months or something like that. And then coordination. So that's All of those are different beasts in there are different stages, but it's really fun to do all of them.
Yeah. I find that the larger companies are the most opaque to me. When you look at a product, say like a hardware software product like the Amazon Echo, what's your estimation as to how many different, would that be something that Amazon could build entirely in-house, or would they typically contract out portions of that for some reason? And how would, I mean, I use Amazon Echo as an example project, but how would people in that position think of building out a product like that? Because at that scale, when you launch a product, like it's different when, even though you're building using many of the same tools and technologies as you would when you're a startup and you're launching a new product, when you're a multi-trillion dollar company and you launch a new product, they, I'm sure, go about it much differently, whether it's testing the market applicability or launch strategy or just the hardware software itself. Yeah, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think it's based on what I've seen at least, right? It's impossible for any company of that size to do everything internally. In some sort of capacity, being QA, being design, being just the conceptualization of the product, being development, software development. And I mean, a hardware product has the hardware development, the software development. There is some, in some capacity, there's subcontracting, there's consulting, there is staff augmentation. I'm pretty sure, I don't have visibility on such a product, but I've seen it in other companies. It's really impossible because, I mean, there is so many resources and there are so many initiatives. So at the end, you will do something, but at the same time, you normally need to expand your team and bring expertise. Like that's part of the, for example, in our case, we decided, okay, let's just be great at fintech. Let's just be great at crypto. And it was because of that. It's like, okay, we're great at product, but we need to be great at an industry. So when somebody that is in this space wants to hire us, let's just be sure that we're ready. We know the tools. We have the partnership. Like, oh, everything checks. Everything checks. So we can, as I was saying, go in, plug, and run instead of just like, okay, start to doing the research. So I'm pretty sure, like, I'm thinking back on the Echo question, I mean, design of some of the prototyping, some may be internal, but some things may be external. I would imagine that, yeah.
Yeah. When you guys focus on crypto and fintech, Are there patterns that you're seeing in the crypto companies that are out there or payment companies where they're looking for, you know, they're all trying to ICO maybe in 2017, or they're all launching coins a couple years ago, or they're all launching NFTs? It seems like there's this industry specific pattern, maybe on Web3 more than others, but similar, I think, on other industries as well. For crypto, are you seeing that? Is everyone trying to get NFTs out the door, or and you guys are effectively trying to help them do that? Or are there other things that crypto companies are trying to do now?
Yeah. So right now, definitely NFTs is one of the key things that I'm seeing. The good thing is that I am always surprised. So there are normally like, well, I want to create an NFT collection and launch. We are less of those, like in our case, we don't that's not our best fit. It's normally, okay, I want to create a platform that uses NFTs for this specific use case. So we are seeing things like, I don't know, NFTs for related to real world. So we're working with a company doing that. We're doing another one, NFTs for more kind of like a social app. So that's super interesting. Then definitely like a marketplace. I guess we're going to see a couple of niche marketplaces because I've seen like I've seen a couple of companies that want to build like niche marketplace, like NFTs for Latin America, NFTs for this type of art. So that's another thing that I see. And then for more financial, like fintechs, it's more about being able to trade. So there are a couple of tools that you could use, like backends like PrimeTrust, ZeroHash, Paxos, that basically give you like kind of like a prepackaged trading platform or backend so that you can integrate to your fintech. So that's the thing I see. The more full fintech financial, they are going more towards the path of using something like that, like the PrimeTrust, like Paxo, the ZeroHash. So that's one thing that I see. Then the more kind of like on the edge are trying to do more using NFTs as some sort of part of I don't know, a platform that they're building. The other thing that I see on those is they're toying with the idea of, okay, a DAO, for example. Is a DAO a good structure for me? With all the uncertainties, right? What's the best legal structure? How do we make it that it's not a security? So that's the other pattern that I see, that it's, do we go traditional and just use this NFTs as part of the business that we're doing, or do we go all in and it's like NFT play with a DAO involved as well?
What value is Paxos and ZeroHash providing? You mentioned them.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So basically, and this is something that we see in the industry, right? And that's something that I like of what's happening on this, I think the terms are open banking, open finance world, right? So I could see that we can separate the fintechs in two spaces. There are the fintechs that are consumer facing, and there are fintechs that are infrastructure providers. Yeah. So, I mean, in the infrastructure providers, there are traditional that we know for connecting bank accounts, MX, for example, they were partners, Plaid or ACH with Wola, for example, things like that. So you see those are more infrastructure providers. They can serve multiple fintechs in what they do. And then you see the consumer-facing fintechs. I mean, in the past, the Mints of the world and all that they touch the end consumer, right? And now you see other companies, Wealth, Kinley, like a lot of those consumer fintech. So those consumer fintech tend to hire those infrastructure fintech. So there is a new trend, for example, that if you want to create a neobank, you don't need to create your core banking backend. And there is, for example, Galileo has been in the space for a while, but there are companies that are doing that. Rise, for example, is a great example that they have the banking account, so checking, savings, account, program management for cards. They do have brokerage, so they provide you the API. So instead of you creating everything, they just like, okay, create a bank account for this user, and they handle everything. They communicate with the bank. So basically, they provide you that. So going back to your question, on the crypto space, those ramp up, ramp down platforms that are called PrimeTrust, ZeroHash, Paxos, they provide you that. Like if I want to trade crypto, instead of building an exchange or building something like that, they already provide you an API that then you can create kind of like the front-facing, consumer-facing platform. And then you use that API for doing all that. And it's you don't own that core banking, but at the same time, it's already reliable, it's secure, you can launch pretty fast. I mean, we have done implementations. And I mean, launching a neobank or being ready for certification, because there are steps for that in 2 months, for example.
Wow.
Just because that accelerates so much that other side of things that it would have taken years to build a fintech in the past. But with that, you can actually launch something pretty quickly.
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting evolution if you think about it from an abstract perspective. It's like the bank doesn't even need to own the technology behind the banking part of the bank, right? And it's like that sounds kind of crazy, but I don't want to own the hosting part of my website. You know, I'd rather just outsource that to AWS, let them handle it, and know that whatever I'm paying in the subscription, you're getting more than that because whatever they're building is being distributed to everyone. So, I mean, hence the magic of software, right? Why build it 100 times or 1,000 times instead of just build it once, sell it, and let people build on top of it?
Exactly. And to your point, like that's what we see. Like basically we see the consumer facing fintech that is the one that creates the bond with the community. That's why we're seeing many niche fintech, like Latino based or like some sort of cohort based. And then you see the infrastructure provider fintech that are serving many of those. And then they are not banks either. They basically connect to a servicing bank that is one that specializes in commercial loans, another one that specializes in personal loans and things like that, like one that is more the credit card provider, for example. So all those things, you see them in the back. You see Visa, like we are thinking, okay, this is revolutionary, but in the back, you always see Visa and MasterCard there. They're servicing all of those companies, which is really interesting because there is an ecosystem that is happening and there's a lot of interconnection. And that's what I like, that basically, You can see, okay, you have to classify, okay, this player does this. And then it's about connecting the dots a little bit. And that's what I like, because as we see many companies and we're doing partnerships, we are able to connect those dots so we can go out quickly.
Yeah. That's interesting. Is there certain technologies that are being adopted now more than previously? I mean, whether it's specific coding languages or frameworks or methodologies, anything that stands out to you as being something you've seen across multiple companies in recent years?
Well, definitely mobile React Native. That's something that I see, for example, in terms of languages. I know we have like full native philosophy. We have Flutter in the space, but I definitely see React Native as the winner. Like we see it all the time. That's one of that we see.
Why is that?
React Native.
So
that's one. Yeah. And React for the web front end. That's another one that I see.
Why is that? What are they doing that other tools aren't doing out there?
So React Native is multi-platform, which is great, but it has great performance. I think the success of React Native is that it follows already what React does. So a developer that already knows React for the web, React.js, can easily transport that knowledge to React Native. They're not the same and they're not equal, completely equal, but they're pretty similar. That's actually one of the reasons when we started to evaluate, okay, do we go for a more multi-platform? We were born as a full native company, right? But we're like, okay, no, let's actually explore these things more openly. And then we went through React Native just because it optimized a lot of the knowledge that we already had. It has great, great performance. You cannot notice actually like that it's a multi-platform framework because they actually generate native components once you compile and all that. So that's one of the things. The other thing is that being multi-platform, there is the advantage that you need a smaller team to launch an app.
Like
normally before it was at least 2 iOS developers, at least 2 Android developers. And then that's 4 people. Then you could have, instead of on the multi-platform React Native, you can have 2 engineers, for example. So that reduces cost. So I think that's one of the things. On the back end, though, I don't see patterns. Like I see some people using, we use Ruby on Rails, Nest.js, Node.js, but we see people using Clojure, for example. We have a client that uses Clojure, so we have trained people. I was talking with a good friend that is in Mercury. Mercury uses Haskell, of all things, as well. So I see different things. I know Nubank uses Haskell as well. We were talking about that. So I don't know, like on the backend languages, I don't see a pattern. And then on the specific fintech and all those, definitely, MX, for example, Banking Connection or Plaid, then Rise, I see them a lot. There are a couple of more players there, Galileo, a unit, for example, Payroll, Pinwheel, Atomic, that's another one that we see. I was mentioning PrimeTrust, Zero Hash, Paxos for crypto. Yeah, so we see a couple of those.
Yeah. I recognize some of those names. What do you think the relationship is between, say, Apple and Google and the team that's building out the React Native? Because if I think about it, Apple is spending a lot of money and time building out their native code environment on Swift, I believe. And if if people are, say, half the market or 70% of the market is using React Native or another native cross-platform tool, it kind of makes the whole point of developing, you know, because Apple is going to make great documentation. They're going to do all this stuff that's consumer-facing, trying to attract developers. Meanwhile, it's like somebody's building a layer on top of them so that you're... is that something that you think is going to trend in one direction? Like Apple ends up just succumbing to this idea that it's going to be cross-platform and they end up becoming like a standard, like singular standard for building. And then, you know, Apple, Google, and it opens the door for more mobile platforms.
Yeah, I don't think that happens.
Yeah.
I honestly, like, I've been in this for a while, like for long, and I don't see them doing it. The good thing of how React Native is built, though, is that there is the space. We always do some native work. Like, for example, if you want to do more very specific app clips, for example, for an app or iMessage integration. So that's going to be, you have to create an extension that it's in Swift, for example, and then you do that. I think it's already so built, like their platforms are already so integrated to what they do that I don't see that happening. Like Android is definitely Kotlin, like a JVM thing. And then Apple is definitely going Swift. They have Objective-C, but it's mostly Swift. So I don't think they're going to, I think we're going to continue with this for years. And again, like the good thing of something like React Native is that it actually uses that native element to it, and you can expand it and connect. So that's the trend, and I think it's going to continue for a while.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting to think about, because on some level, it feels almost like a failure if Apple is building and Google are building out these tools, and then people aren't even using them. They're just becoming absorbed into the next layer of abstraction. It's like, what if no one ends up building on Swift? They all use React Native because it's, you know, or something similar to that.
No, I don't know. But I mean, that's just history of, compilers. There was machine level programming, then there were assembly compilers, then were high level compilers, then were visual tools that combine the compiler. So that's the history. Like there's always that next level of abstraction. Some people are very purist. No, I have to write. But I mean, in reality, how many people do really write machine level code?
Yeah.
It's very few, right? So I think it's just as we want to become more productive, as we want to solve more complex problems, we are always going towards that higher level of abstraction, right?
Yeah. What's after this? What comes next? What level of abstraction?
I don't know. Like, there's always the promise of the no code. There are no code tools, and then there's the AI. AI hasn't performed that, like has performed on specific tasks, but not on such a high level kind of thing. Definitely low code is something that is important, like frameworks that help you solve more specifically. But basically that I can launch, for example, a fintech with very rapidly, but at the same time, I can modify it. So I think that's one thing. We are actually are building on our internal tool that does precisely that. It has all the ready-made integrations. So we can really quickly, literally, our goal is to have first version in minutes and then just expand it and having a POC in a week or so. But I see the trends of the no-code solutions that are more kind of like Webflow did for web, doing that for apps. I've seen a couple, Thunkable. I forget a couple. I just feel that whenever you want to do like a production ready, fully launched, that you can expand, you kind of feel short. So I'm more a low code believer, but definitely I see those two there, like low code solutions and the no code solutions. Yeah.
Do you know anyone that's not using a mouse or keyboard? A few years ago, I saw some products that were coming out pretty early on in beta, but they were using eye tracking to engage as a replacement to the mouse, or like a visual sensory, like an optical sensor to know where your hands were to replace the punching of the keyboards. Certainly VR changes all that, because if you're not using a two-dimensional screen to interact with the computer, then, you know, if you're in a 3D world, yeah, there's just much more context there. In some ways, I can see the tools that I'm using now and see how primitive they are, almost like a, yeah, you know, rewind the clock. Do you get that feeling as well? Do you see it transcending soon?
Yeah, I think maybe I'm old already, in the sense that I've tried a couple. I remember I bought a sensor for interaction with my hands. When it came to Kinect, I did those early tests of connecting the Kinect and use it as an interface. The thing is the efficiency of the tools that we have, like keyboards are super fast for writing. But you know what I've seen, that it's really a trend now that you mentioned? So a lot of our clients now use those note recorders. So every time you start a Zoom call, there is an additional bot there that is just recording everything and transcribes it. I don't know what happens on the other side, but that's actually a trend that I've seen, that it's really useful, because it basically just does the notes. But on input devices of other type, no, I don't know anyone. Maybe I'll just hang out with old people. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's gonna excuse me. It's gonna happen some point. What about on crypto specifically? Are there platforms that you're seeing that are gaining more traction, or maybe methodologies that are gaining more or less traction that you're seeing? In the industry.
Well, definitely. I mean, on the Web3 space, that's where we move the most. You always see the Ganesh and Truffle for development, for sure. We always see the Open Zeppelin contracts as a basis for ERC-20 tokens and NFTs and all that. On more evolved platforms, I really like what Juicebox is doing. I don't know if you've seen them. It's where Constitution DAO was.
Oh, okay.
They're launching their second version.
Let me ask you that. Yeah. So when these guys made Constitution DAO, I know many people are familiar with the project. From your technical perspective, how much technical work went into building Constitution DAO? Like anywhere from none to, you know, they spent thousands of hours. Like what went into that technically to spin that up from their perspective?
So the interesting thing is that Constitution DAO as a project didn't create the technology. So there was the Juicebox team that they had created Juicebox. They had some success, like there were some projects being funded and everything. And then all of a sudden, there is this 43 million project that appeared, like gained so much traction. They got funded. I know they were working because I saw them work for another DAO called SharkDAO. So at least they had, at least they had like 6 months of working on it. I guess it probably is one of those things that was intense for a couple of months. And then you start to see, okay, does it have traction or not? And then all of a sudden, this 43 million project gets funded there. And that helped people discover Juicebox. So I know their treasury got huge. Like they had, I don't know how much money they had at the beginning, but then all of a sudden, I think they raised like $20 million on their Juicebox, which was super funny. So I think, they probably took like a couple of months. It's on a Discord that's fully open source. So it's really fun to see. We're interacting basically. For this project, Studio DAO, we are building on top of Juicebox. So it's really cool just to see and the how they think about making a protocol for funding and less than just a platform, as you normally see on I don't know, Kickstarter or similar. They're thinking about the protocol and how to extend it and where do they stop and where us, for example, can extend it. So that's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, yeah. How about, you know, after COVID and pandemic, everyone went remote and so many companies are now completely distributed across the globe, or at least, you know, across North and South America or vertically across their time zone. Are you seeing a a large growth in South America, certainly before, I'm sure, the pandemic. It's true, but are you seeing companies growing out of South America, or more or less people joining engineering teams and development teams, maybe marketing teams?
Yeah, so both. So definitely this is, I think this is going to be the decade for Latin America engineering, in the sense that, I mean, hiring, we do constant hiring, right? And we can see a lot of the competition, like a few years ago, it wasn't that common, but now you see startups that are working with recruiting agencies, they're working more with agencies. Like in the past, I think like if you saw it, I don't know, 20 years ago, it was all about India, right? And then 10 years ago, it was about East Europe, probably. But right now, you can see team growing in Latin America. We're super happy because we've been in the space for so long. So just seeing how our countries are thriving there in Latin America, that's great. So there is a lot of the hiring, like joining as an engineer, as a designer, as a marketer, similar culture, similar time zone and all that. The other thing that we're also seeing is tech companies being born in Latin America. And we have really interesting successes. Nubank just did IPO. So that's a neobank based in Brazil and Colombia, now Mexico. It's entirely built in Latin America, for example. So that's a great example. We see the Platzi's of the world, that's more in the education space. I mean, there are a couple, like I think now, I remember even a few years ago, there were no unicorns, one unicorn in Argentina or something like that. And then out of the sudden, I think that we're on the 10 to 15 unicorns, which is still feels small, but you have to be cognizant of the stage that Latin America.
It's also a small country. I mean, they're only, what, 20 million, something like that? 30 million people? Right.
No, not really, because if you think about the aggregate Latin America, I think it's 500 million people.
Oh, yeah. Take Argentina, Brazil, 45 million.
Colombia, Argentina. Oh, yeah. So, but if you see like the aggregate, definitely, that's the interesting thing, that there is a high, like, it's a big area. There's a lot of people. There's great engineering. There are great engineering schools. So definitely I see that as a trend. And I would believe that this is definitely the decade for Latin America.
You sound excited about that. I noticed the accent. Are you from somewhere in South America or have family down there? Or do you speak Spanish?
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Honduras.
Okay.
So I was doing business in the U.S. with a company, and then we decided to just open office, and that's how in 2016 I moved to L.A. with Alejandro, my business partner as well, and we said, okay, if we want to grow the way we want to grow, let's just go put food in L.A. We landed a contract with Disney, and then that's actually what propelled the company at the time. And then a couple of years ago is when we decided to, okay, now let's expand and diversify. So fintech, crypto were very natural to us. And then plus the other experience in entertainment.
Yeah. And about 60 people in the company, is that right?
Yeah. So right now we are 70 plus and growing. So I think our next goal is 100 people by July. I think we're going to be at that milestone. And then from that, we're also doing a play, again, building this framework. So we want to grow not only in size of people, but actually have more technology solutions play. That's what we believe. Like, we don't want to be a Globant or a EPAM or something like that, that have 10,000 people. We see ourselves more as helping you with solutions, more personal, but at the same time, having ready-made solutions, a framework for developing fast.
So what's the difference there? You're saying you don't want to be a Globant, meaning you don't want to be too large, or...
Yeah, so if you see the industry of the software development agencies, there are different philosophies and everything, right? So, but one of them is, I am good because I am big. Mm. So the big ones of the world tend to be, Globant. There are several, but I know Globant from Argentina, and then EPAM that is in East Europe, Russia and such. So they are huge companies, publicly traded, but they are in the job of selling people to companies, right? So that's kind of like their model. So those are the gorillas in the market, for example. And then there are others that are more smaller agencies, like our niche-based agencies and everything. We see ourselves more into, okay, we want to grow, but at the same time, we want to grow in a model where it's not only about selling people time to companies, but actually providing value and expertise in something like this, fintech, crypto, having solutions already for launching quickly, things like that. So creating a framework that can help you do that pretty quickly.
How did you go from, was it simple to go from Honduras to LA to landing this deal with Disney? I mean, it was immigration simple, or was it, was there major challenges to do that? I mean, I would imagine it's probably not as easy as you're making it sound.
It's, I mean, the good thing of both entrepreneurs and immigrants, we're going to continue doing it until we succeed, right? So it was a process for sure. Like, I mean, from the first, the fear of, okay, will I make it? Do I have enough money? So doing the financial model for that, hiring a lawyer, working on the process. So that was looking for the right visa. We wanted to have a visa that would allow us to grow, to stay, to expand. So we use one that is called L1 visa, which is basically we open an office here and then we transfer ourselves from the Honduras office to the US. So that was super interesting. In the middle, there were hiccups. They asked for different information. You're not such a huge company, but the law doesn't restrict the size of the company, but they have to be sure that you're a company that will come here and succeed and grow. So it's a lot of paperwork. We had a couple of rejections in the middle that we had to appeal and then won. It's all a process, but gladly, last year, we were doing that all the time, renewing and everything. Last year, I got my permanent residence. I feel like 30% of my brain is now free, because you always have that in your mind. Like, it's like, okay, I'm building all this and we are being successful, but at the same time, I have to worry about renewing my visa again, and I'm in the middle of this permanent residency process. Will it happen or not? So that's difficult. I mean, it could be easier for sure. I would love that the process would be easier, but at the same time, I mean, I'm a persistent person. So right. So it's I don't take no for an, like I if I think that I can definitely do something and should, like I'm really persistent. So yeah, we finally succeeded at that stage.
How many people were in the company when you moved it to the US? Because it sounds like the L1 allows you to start a company somewhere else in another country, open an office here, transfer yourself here, like you said, which to me is a great way to do it if you have, say, a large business and you want to move people there. But I can certainly see the gap there if people were to take advantage of that instead of, say, immigrating through the standard, forget the name of the H-1B, right? Instead of that, you say, hey, let's spin up a company, I have some money, and then let's transfer myself there. Is there, I would imagine that loophole may not actually be there?
Yeah, no, there is no loophole in that sense. The good thing is the law doesn't require you to have a specific number of people, but it must be an operating business. And that's a good thing. We had a real operating business. And one thing that the lawyer always told us is, look, I'm afraid about this, like the size, like some of those signs. But the good thing is that you're a real operating business. So we had statements, we had employees, we had all that. To your question, we were small, we were tiny at the time. Like we were five people most of the time. When we were at the end of that process and planning on moving, we hired two more people. So it's funny because we were seven people when we just landed here. When we landed the contract with Disney in the process of doing that, just because of a technology that they were using from us. But basically that propelled us to the next step. So we were from seven to 20 something pretty quickly, like in months. So that was an interesting process. But your question to the L1, the key thing is that you have a real operating business and then you transfer your executive. You can actually do that transfer by creating a plan of what your business is going to be. They give you a one-year visa that it's kind of like the new office. And that's what they gave us. Although we were already working, like we were already traveling a lot to the U.S. We were already incorporated in the U.S. and doing business. But since we didn't have an office and nobody from us and from our company was here, they consider us a new office. type of visa. So that was a year. And then after that year, you have to prove a couple of things that we did, that we opened the office, that we're selling, that we're doing several things, the next step of the plan. And then it was a couple of times of every 2 years we had to.
Right.
You have to kind of show where you are, where you're going. You have to sell a little bit the company, right?
So it sounds pretty subjective, like you're submitting this paperwork in and then you're just, it's not a black and white thing. You're just kind of hoping it's enough.
It is not. Although, you know what? The asks are pretty specific. It is subjective in a sense because there is a person that, but I think if you follow a good structure, well, I changed lawyers in the middle. So I've been working with my other lawyer and saw the difference on how well they, like, well, the law says this, 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 and this. So let's answer all of them. It's like, okay, this person applies because of this and this, this, and this is true because of this, this is true. And then thus, because the law says this and we have proven that all of this, then this is what's like, you should get it. And I mean, the way of the structure of the message was so impressive to me. And I mean, I think they asked for one additional document and then it was approved. So there is some subjectivity, but at the same time, I think it's about how well you structure the message according to the law.
Yeah. Do you feel like the process is fair? I mean, there's been a lot of political agitation about immigration, and certainly Trump had that as his primary, one of his primary ideas on trying to decrease immigration. To me, there's a lot of political debate on immigration, but in my view, and I'd love to hear your reaction to this, it seems like the move should be make immigration easier for people who are people that would make the society better, and you could talk about that, but make it easier for those people, but then also make it harder for people to come in illegally. So there's also less of an incentive, because I don't think even the people coming in illegally or undocumented don't want to come in undocumented, but they have no other means to come in. And if you just made it much, much easier, like immigration, it just makes, you know, the bigger your market, the more goods and services you have. So this idea that people take jobs is so ridiculous because we all help each other, right? Whatever people do, if it's valuable in society, it's because it's creating value and offering value to other people. So anyways, do you feel like the immigration process is fair, or do you feel like it's dramatically broken? Like, where are we on that spectrum?
Yeah, I actually think that both are true in the sense, I think it was fair according to the laws that exist right now. What I don't think is that the laws and the processes that exist right now are necessarily good.
Outdated? So
that's what I think I was treated fairly in my process, but it was outdated, it was super slow, some things were not clear. There should be models for certain type of visas. There should be, I am a strong believer, there should be a path for people that are here, that have been here for years, and they are already contributing a lot to the society. So in the sense that I think the laws that exist, I was treated fairly, but I think that we should change the laws and update them to the reality of this century. Mm-hmm. That's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if as the internet allows for people to work so easily across borders, but yet we still have these age-old, outdated rules as to where you can physically live. It seems like the fact that people are so integrated across societies and countries, you can work in a company with 1,000 people and they might have people in 50 or 70 different countries. And that's only going to continue to happen. And as people become more intermeshed together, it seems like there's increasing social pressure to make the physical travel more fluid, which I hope happens. How about I want to ask you this? How about English? So English has been the dominant language that the internet was written in. You know, with the internet being invented in the U.S. and in Western countries, is kind of proliferated first. Now, of course, it's everywhere in the world, the internet, but so much of software just has a fundamental English core construct to it. With people in South America speaking native Portuguese and Spanish for the most part, and obviously in other parts of the world, people speak all different languages. Do you see a change in that, or is English becoming sort of the default standard of the internet, and that's the way you see it for the foreseeable future, and everyone learns English for that purpose? Or how are people working together across many different countries like that?
Yeah, no, I think English is lingua franca for sure, both for commerce and for programming. From even the fact that programming languages, the keywords are in English. Like, if you think about it, even from the basic constructs of programming languages, they are in English. So I think it's lingua franca. You see, like, there is a lot of influence from, especially the U.S. To Latin America. So a lot of the people in Latin America understands some of the English. They may have problems speaking it, although there's a lot of bilingual education. So there's a lot of people that speak English. In our case, we see two tracks in people. Normally, they're people that already come from a bilingual education, or they learn it at college. They speak and read pretty well. So we have that group of people. And then for those that don't, what we really did is we're like, I mean, you're really good. We have we create a partnership with an English education company. It's actually the American school in Honduras. So basically, we just take them to a fast track. It's a year and a half of full English. We have also coaches for conversation, just because, I mean, they're really good. It's just like it's a communication problem, but we can solve that. There are solutions for that, and we've seen it. It's very successfully. People are grateful. Clients, they don't notice it. Like, they're super happy. They feel like they have a English speaking person. Yeah, I'm testing this app called Bold Voice. It's a Y Combinator recently out that it's about pronunciation, just because I think the next level, without losing our accents are a part of our identity and the beauty of how we speak, right? But at the same time, I think it's a good practice to learn a little bit more the pronunciation so the communication is clearer. So I'm trying that app and see what happens. But I'm very early in the first few weeks of using it.
So what does it do? It gives you feedback on your pronunciation?
Yeah. It gives you, it's like AI. So they have videos of how to pronounce things and then some exercises, and it uses AI just to check how good your pitch. Yeah. So one of the things that I've discovered in that is that in English, and I had noticed it unintentionally, but you use a lot your throat, like kind of like there is a hum on many of the words and the vowels and the consonants. I wasn't aware of that. That in Spanish, you talk more from your mouth. So it does. That's why when we Latinos speak English, it sounds a little bit different to the U.S. Even a U.S.-based Latino is just because we use more the mouth than the throat.
Oh, interesting. I never thought about that. I wonder. I mean, it seems like I think about what it takes for the entire world to be able to work together, because that's like the holy grail of human flourishing and kind of an online renaissance of sorts. And certainly the the revolution around the sun makes it so that unless people, are nocturnal, we're going to have the time zone problem for the foreseeable future. And so, like you were alluding to earlier, when the craze came around of the U.S. offshoring jobs to India, well, we actually learned that there's a huge price you pay for language, for culture, and definitely for time zone differences. South America is a lot more interesting for that benefit. On blockchain payments, company growing, we've talked about a lot of stuff. Anything that you wanted to throw out in the last few minutes? Any ideas that have been topical for you, or trends that you've seen that you think others may not have seen, or books or people that you learn from? I'm just throwing some cues out there.
That's an interesting question. I think the one of the main trends that definitely I alluded to earlier was there is already a lot of infrastructure in place in this new age of fintech and crypto, especially in fintech, I would say, that it's so interesting because we are starting to see a lot of different business models and a lot of niches, like serving a specific niche that I think it wasn't really possible that easily before. I mean, the fact that there are those infrastructures already makes it faster, cheaper. And it's all about connecting the dots. So now I'm like, what you would think before, like a few years ago, is like, okay, I want to do this. Oh, that's going to be a heavy lift because I have to be, I have to comply with all these things. And a lot of that is already prepackaged or solved at some point, as to a certain point by a company. That it's a lot of the work, it's about connecting those dots. I think that's super important. That's definitely something that I see. And then yeah, the other thing that I'm thrilled is about the DAOs. I mean, they look so similar to, I don't know, co-ops. They have some corporation component, but they are their own thing. And there's definitely that legality void right now. Like, how exposed are you if you're the starting team from a DAO? At some point, you are exposed. What if the SEC thinks this is a security, for example? But at the same time, the fact that organizations that give back to their members right away are appearing, that's also super interesting to me, just to see that concept of exit to community instead of like that you form the community, but that community benefits. And at the same time, that community generates value, promotes the company. So that's another thing that I'm definitely very interested. There is a book about it, now that you talk about it, it's the Radical Markets book. I think it's a great reading about this side of things. Like, we come from a world that thinks in a certain way, but with this tokenized economy, with these open markets, with these DAOs, for example, things are changing. And I like that he takes a really interesting approach of trying to analyze like real estate, like even like hiring, for example, from that perspective. So that's a great book for sure that I would recommend to somebody that's interested in all this world of the DAOs and all that.
Say the name again.
Radical Markets.
Markets. Yeah, I'll check that out. Jorge, congrats on all the progress. Yeah, I know you've been working on this business for a long time, over 10 years, right? And you guys have made incredible progress. I really love the perspective that you have, you know, seeing the underbelly of so many of these companies. So it was really fun to get to know you, hear your perspectives, your thoughts on technology and countries and the world and how it's changing. So yeah, I wish you nothing but the best, man. And thanks for coming on today.
Awesome. No, thank you. Super excited. Again, like, thank you for inviting me. This was great. Great conversation. So thank you. And thank you, everyone.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Around the Coin. If you enjoyed the show today, consider giving us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts, tweet about it, or text it to a friend. We really appreciate all the support and growing that we can. If you have any guests you'd like us to bring on or feedback for us, don't hesitate to reach out. We would love to hear from you.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.